Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Club Scouts, and welcome to another episode of Bigfoot Collectors Club, the show where we talk to amazing guests about their personal paranormal history and share stories of high strangeness. I am your host, Michael McMillan. With me always is your other host,
Bryce Johnson,
and our super producer,
Riley Bray.
Oh, it's a scorcher, boys. I hope everybody's staying safe in this heat, because I sat down to record this episode and I'm already sweating my balls off.
Yep. I've just accepted that I'm just a little bit sweaty all the time now. Maybe forever.
Yeah, you know? Probably forever and ever. If you're listening on the West Coast and you're dealing with all this massive heat wave, we hope you're doing well. Find some place cool to sit, and we'll keep you company for the next hour or so. Boys, Bryce, big announcement on the social medias today.
Yeah.
We can say it. Why don't you say it?
Yeah, it's official. Season 3 of Expedition Bigfoot is underway. We got a pickup.
Congratulations. Yeah. I was sipping water and I couldn't say congrats. It looks like filming has started. I know you can't tell us anything. Can you tell us if production is underway?
Yes, production is underway. So I know it's always so funny. It's like 2 months ago, I'm like, hey, I need more of your Bigfoot stories for a secret project. We've been around that block before, but it's hard keeping the word mom and playing coy, but it's nice to be able to officially let our fans know that we'll be back. So I'm really excited about it. I love this gig. I love the people I work with, and the fans are great. And it's a blast, man.
I mean, I'm going to ask you, for everybody who listened to our Patreon series where we covered every episode of the show last season, I got to ask you for a little tease. What do you got? You got something for us already, don't you?
Man, I'm going to keep mum. I have nothing to say except it's going to be fucking fantastic. As much as I don't want to, let me go turn off my air conditioner.
All right.
It's on an energy saver.
Stand while Bryce is doing that and being lame, Club Scouts.
It's about as much information as that UFO
sucks.
Report.
This sucks, guys. Like, we should be getting the scoops, and he won't tell us a goddamn thing. Club Scouts.
All right.
You can support the show by subscribing to our Patreon, BCC The Other Side, for $5 a month. You get 3 to 5 bonus episodes every month that you can listen to from our Patreon homepage or on your favorite podcast app, just like how you're listening to this right now. The Other Side is the parallel dimension of the Bigfoot Collectors Club with full-length episodes you can only listen to exclusively when you join the Patreon at patreon.com/Bigfoot Collectors Club. And if you just want to put a small tip in the Bigfoot jar, you can do so over buymeacoffee.com, the link to which you can find in our link tree in our Instagram and Bigfoot Collectors Club, at Bigfoot Collectors Club, and on our Twitter at Bigfoot Pod. And finally, you can always support the show by leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we might read it on the air, like this one that Bryce is going to read for you right now.
Nostalgic, hilarious, mystical, and weird. 5 stars. You boys are so much fun together. Every time I listen, I feel like I'm hanging out with friends. Perfect blend of paranormal and laughs. My dream is to hang out with you at the clubhouse. This podcast and their amazing Patreon has helped my mental health and emotional stability so much. Hearts. Thank you so much. I love hearing that.
That's so nice.
That's fantastic. And
you know what? It's helped my mental health and emotional stability.
I'm going to say mine too.
As well. So.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it's a little. It's a little up and down for me, to be honest. I mean, for the most part, yes. But when we're knee deep in wet, hot Alien Summer 2, Summer Abduction, like we are right now, I failed to mention that, everybody. I am starting to like the night terrors are starting to creep in a little bit. Guys, help keep those night terrors away, listeners. Give us a 5-star review. If we get 1,000 5-star reviews, we will record the BCC Jet Ski Special. We are currently at 736. Just need you guys to cross those last few hundred. And if we get 1,000 Patreon subscribers before the end of the summer, Bryce will ride one of those jet skis naked. So you know what to do, Club Scouts. Your summer depends on it. Okay.
Sounded so much better the first time we said it. Now it just feels... weird. Like, but still true.
So. Still true. Still weird. Always
He's
will
a
be.
Man of his word.
Speaking of weird, in a different way, in a much more fun way, our guest tonight is one of the best known investigators of UFO, paranormal, and occult phenomena in America. He's an author, researcher, podcaster, producer, director, and yes, even actor. A real Renaissance weirdo. Please welcome back to the clubhouse, Mr. John E.L. Tenney.
Woo! All right.
Hey, guys. What's going on?
What's going on, John?
Oh, what? You know, just keeping it weird. Wet, hot alien summer.
What's more haunted, the last haunted house you went to or the first 3 minutes of this episode?
The idea of Bryce naked on jet ski will haunt me for the rest of my life. So.
Good. Our work is done then.
John, how have you been, man? I think the last time we spoke to you here in the clubhouse was, I believe, around this time last summer during Wet Hot Alien Summer, the first. I want to catch up on what you've been up to in the past year. Maybe we can kick things off with you were talking about researching a phenomenon in, I believe it's Michigan where you're based.
Oh, I remember this.
Formanauts.
Yeah. Yeah. What? So I started researching, I got a weird case in 2018 of some people who had seen something strange, a strange creature in their neighborhood. And so I went out and talked to them and then do what I do, which is walk around the neighborhood and knock on doors and ask anybody if they've seen anything weird. I think that's the hardest part of my job, right? Is to cold call people on their strangeness. And over the course of about a year and a half, I found that we had in Michigan some type of wave of strange creatures, which I was calling Formanauts, still calling them Formanauts. But it was everything from weird looking robotic aliens with like aquarium fish tank heads to giant furry floating boxes that moved through trees and cars to little triangles that ran around on the ground. It was still absolutely bizarre. And so I've just been writing about that and trying to put together all of the different information of like what time of night they happened, what days they happened, what the moon phases were. The age of the people, like everything, and trying to find something that would maybe give me any idea of what was happening.
Wow, that is psychedelic. Have you gotten Seriously. Any closer to a working theory? And can you tell us again why you call them the Formanauts?
Yeah, so I was originally in my handwritten notes with the first case, I just kept writing humanoid creature. And then when I stumbled onto like the second case, it wasn't humanoid. It was this like 3-foot by 3-foot box that seemed to be covered in hair with some lights inside of it that passed through a tree and a fence and was seen by a couple of people. I'm like, well, that's not a humanoid. I can't call these humanoids anymore. And then I started wondering, like, if this is the same creature that's just taking different forms, then it's a Formanaut. It's sailing through forms. It's taking a form that's specific and individualized to each experiencer, if it's the same thing.
Killer. That's a great name too.
Yeah, I love that term. Yeah.
This sounds, Yeah, go on, John.
I was just going to say, it was super crazy because, you know, when you're talking, when I'm talking to people, like the black triangles that were on the ground that people saw running around, you know, I was in this neighborhood and I was asking people going door to door and saying, like, you know, have you seen anything weird? This is my name. Here's my card. You know, I'm not bothering you. Don't want to bother you. And, you know, I had this first report of this black triangle that was illuminated on top and it was supposedly running through this neighborhood. And I was talking to this one gentleman about three blocks away, and he said, no, I haven't really seen anything weird except, you know, last week on this certain day, which was the day that this triangle got spotted running around. He said, I saw this weird thing. It was like a black cat with birthday candles on it running around.
What?
Wow.
And I was like, it was a black cat. And he's like, well, yeah, it was like real low to the ground, like a black cat, and had little birthday candles on it. And I'm thinking to myself, like, oh, he saw this same thing, but doesn't have any frame of reference. Like in his mind, it must have been a black cat running around with birthday candles on it. And then in my brain, I'm laughing because I'm like, that's even stranger to me than a black triangle with lights on it running around.
That is a trip.
That's fucking insane. That's great. What? So how does a black triangle? So, you know, when you say black triangles, I'm thinking of the big UFO ships. This is obviously something different. This is like this sounds like something out of Alice in Wonderland, like little fractal patterns, like running around on two legs legs.
Yeah.
What are they running?
Yeah.
Around
so
on?
The original witness to this strange Formanaut type thing described it as maybe about 4 inches thick and about 1.5 feet wide as a triangle. And it had three little legs underneath it. And it had these little illuminated lights on the top, and it was running down the street and under cars. And then he watched it move up a fence and then kind of float down from the fence. He said as it came over the fence, it descended slowly and then took off running again.
This is like we're all living in some weird like Pixar movie that we don't know that we're just humans in a Pixar movie that are there to react to whatever little fantasy creature is like having a chase sequence. You know what I mean? Like don't you think that maybe that they're the real stars of the show and we're just here to like go, whoa, and swerve a car.
Yeah. So that little triangle can like learn about the importance of being itself. That's why we're really here.
I mean, I have a question. I mean, it feels so something like that feels so fresh and new. And I've never heard or read anything about that. Does that change your approach to your investigation or, you know, because it doesn't seem like old hat and there's not a lot of theories that have been floated around about it. So do you like when something like this happens? It feels, you know, all your own, really. I mean, like you get to sort of come to bring this to people's minds and attentions and sort of get a grasp on it yourself before anyone else. What is that like?
Yeah, it's interesting because the way that I research stuff and the things that I'm fascinated with, what ends up happening is I get that initial excitement of like, oh, I'm going to be the first person that kind of is involved with this thing. And then as I start researching, like, giant floating furry boxes. Like I find cases from the 30s and the 50s where people saw floating boxes. And I'm like, oh, this is just happened before. It's just being noticed again now. So,
wow.
Like all of this stuff seems crazy and new to me, but also in the back of my mind is like, okay, research this because it probably happened to someone else at some other time.
And yeah. You're right. It did. That's incredible.
I remember, John, when I was doing research for the Enfield Monster, I found this article. I'm pulling it up now from the Republic Times, St. Louis. This is from 2017. I think I sent this to you, but there was a UFO story in the 60s. I'm pulling it up here. Once there, hometown of Fairfield. One such sighting occurred on August 4th of 1963. The story involves two teenagers on their way back from a drive-in movie being chased by what seemed to be a UFO. The story tells of the object speeding up as the car sped up, chasing them all the way to the girlfriend's house. Once there, the teenagers went inside the house, turned out the lights, and watched through the window as a lit up fuzzy object about the size of a washtub hovered outside the house. As the teenagers watched from inside the house, a sister of the girlfriend was also witness to the unexplained happening. And just reading that washtub size fuzzy UFO that lit up from the inside, I was like, this sounds like one of those Formanot things that John investigated.
It's super crazy. And this is the other thing that drives me nuts too, because I do love to try and think as weirdly as possible about this stuff, is as a researcher who loves weird stuff, I imagine myself to be pretty well informed with the strange cases, but then I have like these giant furry boxes and I've never heard of them before. And then I start researching and people like you send me cases that are similar to it. And I'm like, oh, did these cases even exist in the past before it happened now? Like, is it retro causality? Like, is it happened in the future and then it bounces itself backwards? Because why didn't I find these stories in the past before?
Yeah.
I like that. Uh-oh.
Yeah, we touched upon that when we were chatting about like cases like the Mothman and stuff, where it's like maybe this stuff does work its way backward through time, like it anchors itself in the future and then ripples or in the present and then ripples forward and backward down the timeline.
Well, just the idea that the past is malleable, you know what I mean? I love that, that it's not set in stone, that it as well can still change. I mean, the future certainly isn't set, but maybe neither is the past.
Or something can engage the timeline outside of the timeline. Like if you're playing the piano, right? Okay, this might actually work as a metaphor. But if you're playing the piano, let's say that you got two hands on the keyboard. Say the left of the keyboard is like 1920 and the right of the keyboard is 2021. You know what I mean? Okay. But you're playing it at the same time. You know what I mean? So whoever's engaging with it is playing two different years simultaneously, right? And they may not have done it at any point until they did. Like the Formanauts may not have decided to pick up and play the piano until now. And so they're entering our time stream in the present and in the 60s or some other time period. Or, you know what I mean? That kind of works, yeah, right? That works as a metaphor, right?
I want to know more about who's playing this piano and what he's sitting on. Piano, and is he wearing fuzzy underwear?
Definitely has like a sick robe and like hair.
Just like glowing. Oh, no, he's got a sick robe.
Yeah, definitely some kind of space wizard.
Yeah, it's got a high collar. It's just John. It's just the Elton John. It's just literally Elton John. So what is your takeaway with this stuff right now? Like, where are you at? Like Bryce said, where are you at with that case? And then what other stuff have you been looking into recently?
Yeah. So I'm just finishing up trying to, I mean, it's not really going to be a book. I mean, it'll maybe be 150 pages or something, but it's mostly just like charts and graphs of like the time it happened and what people saw. And I've had all of the witnesses do their own sketches of what they saw. And then I either sat with them or one of my friends who's a professional artist sat with them and drew what they saw. So you get the witness sketch and like a more professional sketch of what they saw. So hopefully that'll be done by Christmas. I'm really kind of hoping to get that done. You know, obviously the pandemic put the kibosh on a lot of stuff. Right. But I mean, aside from that, it's just been like jumping hard into like working on cases that are coming up around, like a lot of ghost stuff happened during the pandemic just because people were in their houses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most people aren't awake and aware inside of their houses as much as they have been for the past year and a half. And so they started noticing all of the weird shit that's probably always going on, but they're just noticing it for the first time.
Yeah. I remember reading that. I think it was a New York Times article, but I might be mistaken, Somebody reported on the, upflux of activity of ghost-like sightings and wrappings in their home while being stuck inside.
Yeah, that was me.
Right. Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. Well, there you go. That's when you're the OG source right there.
No, it was literally just him hiding in a wall and knocking on it. John's just been living in people's walls during the pandemic. That's what he's.
I'm trying to keep myself busy, you know?
Yeah. Where do you think, time of day wise, I think we've chatted a little bit about this before. I know John Keel was like, Wednesdays at such and such, time is a good time to see UFOs. Has there ever been a place or a time for you that you're like, oh, if I go here, I know something's going to happen. Or this time of day, I always experience a synchronicity of some kind.
There was, just talking to someone about this earlier today, but there was a house in Hamtramck, Michigan, which is about 7 miles away from where I live. And I had access to it. It was an abandoned house, and it had some stories about ghosties in it or whatever. And I asked the owner if I could investigate. He said, yeah. And like I said, it was abandoned property. And he pretty much gave me the keys to it and said, you know, go in whenever you want. And so I spent a couple years going there, staying there overnight, weeks on end, trying to like categorize and classify when weird sounds would happen, when weird feelings would happen. And after like 2 years, I really did narrow it down to like, you know, the on Thursday nights between 1 and 1:30, like there's going to be a weird thing that happens. Mm. Like it just happens. This is the pattern that this house seems to be on. And I took people there at that time and told them, like, this is what's going to happen. Like, you're going to hear this sound and we're not going to know where it comes from. You're going to hear this voice, no idea who's speaking. And it really freaked me out. And it got to the point where I was like, okay, now after 2.5 years, I want to bring scientists into this. And so I contacted like University of Michigan, talked to some people there at Wayne State, the colleges around town, and started putting everything together. And as if on cue, it's just outside of Detroit, someone burned the house down.
Hmm. You're kidding me.
Whoa.
And that has always really, it still to this day breaks my heart. There's another house in Indian Village in Detroit. You talk about strange cases. This husband and wife moved into this turn of the century arts and crafts kind of mission home in Indian Village. And there was a dining room table in the kind of setting dining room. And the dining room table was this giant oak table. And the room had been built around the table. Like you couldn't get the table out of the room. There were no doors big enough. And it was this solid hulking piece of oak. And the people called me in because pencils were falling out from underneath the table. So I went to the house and there's a pencil under the table. They show me, they're like, okay, there's the pencil. And they took the pencil out from under the table. And I'm like, okay, so what's the situation? And
do you mean like, well, do you mean like materializing out of nowhere, like aporting pencils?
Yes.
Wow.
Whoa.
And so I said, I took the pencil and I'm like, so what's the deal? And they're like, well, you have to leave the room. Nobody can be looking. And so we turned around and literally took 2 steps, none of us looking. And I hear a pencil hit the ground. I look under the table and there's a pencil. It's a different pencil, but I'm still holding the one I took, you know? So I take it and I'm looking under the table. I'm laying on the floor. I'm pressing up against the table, like with my hands, trying to find like secret drawers. How are these people fooling me? Like, what's going on? And I stand up and I started to walk toward them. They were in the living room. And as soon as I stood up and was facing them, I hear a pencil hit the floor. And I look back and there's another pencil on the table. And I'm like, how long has this been going on? And they're like, it always goes on. Like, we usually just leave the pencil there because it gets really annoying. And I go in their kitchen. They have cups and glasses full of pencils.
Can you describe the pencils? Are they just like standard number twos or?
Everything you can imagine. Pencils from the turn of the century. Pencils, you know, that are semi-plastic and kind of wood. Those ones that you can kind of bend. Some are sharpened down to nubs. Some are brand new. Some of the erasers are like every pencil that you can imagine.
This is where all of our pencils go when we lose our pencils.
That was my idea. I was like, this is when people lose pencils, they fall under this table. Like no other explanation for it. So we moved. Like I moved the table around the room. I put cameras on it. If anybody or anything was watching the table, it wouldn't drop a pencil.
Wow.
As soon as you turned the cameras off and turned away, you'd hear the pencil hit the floor. And I was like super excited. And again, this was a few years after that house in Hamtramck. So I go back, I find more professors at University of Michigan, Michigan State University, Wayne State, Schoolcraft College. And I'm like, okay, I need you guys to come and see this. This is paranormal phenomena. And it's reproducible. It's happening like all the time. So,
and what are they saying?
I started talking. I have enough pull and I have enough friends that are in enough colleges to where I can get some people to go, well, he's not totally nuts. Let's go see what he's talking about. It helps to have a sister. My sister is a professor at the University of Michigan, so that helps too.
Totally.
So I'm talking to the homeowners, and they're like, yeah, we've sold the house. We're moving out. So if you're going to make this happen, like, it's got to happen, you know, in the next like 4 or 5 days. So I got one like grad student from this smaller college, Schoolcraft, to come with me and see these pencils and was documenting it. And he went back and told the chair, like, you've got to come and see this. It's absolutely amazing. And we went back to the house, I think probably about a week and a half later, and the house was locked and the couple had moved out. So I was like, well, I'll just, that table can't be moved out of this house. So I'll just wait until the next people buy the house and do this all over again. And the people who bought the house tore the walls out, tore the doors down, smashed the table apart, threw everything. Like, it's all gone. The whole house has been re-renovated. Wow. It's like Property Brothers came in and just smashed everything. So those are the only two instances when I had reproducible phenomena. And in both cases, the universe fought me on it and wouldn't allow, I mean, one college undergrad student to see it.
That's so, I mean, so, yeah. So why here's where we get into the nitty gritty, right? When you're like, the universe wouldn't let anybody else see it. Or do you think there's a sentience there that's a part of that, that, I don't know, it's hard not to get conspiratorial, especially when that house burnt down. I mean, look, you can, you know, put it up to happenstance, sure, but I don't know, man. It feels just like, and like even you said, maybe the universe knew that the house was going to be sold, torn apart, and that nobody would ever get in to actually study it repeatably, verifiably. You know what I mean? It's like, again, you know, it's that trickster element.
At the point that I'm at, now I'll be 50 this year, and I've been doing this for 30 years. And the way that I currently think about stuff, I really do have this idea that, you know, you always hear people talk about like the universe is all one thing. Like, we're all just one thing.
Right.
And I really do feel like whatever experiences I have, or you have, whatever, like it's me. It's I am the universe. If we're all one thing, it's just me, like, playing with me.
Wow.
Like, I'm driving myself nuts. Like, it's like, oh, look at what I'm going to give you. It's, you know, me talking to you, you're just me in disguise, and you're leading me on this path. And I feel like the phenomena is that way too. It's just me in an alternate realm fucking with me.
I love that.
You're such a bastard to yourself, John.
I think, but it's what we all do to ourselves, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
I think that a lot of times can account for like synchronicities and coincidences too. Like, you know, you're going to be there. So why wouldn't you go and fuck with yourself and keep yourself on the path of weirdness?
I've had this thought too. It's the same sort of idea as if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound? If I close my eyes and ears and all my senses off to the world, do any of you really exist? You know?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I still exist.
No, Riley, no. No, you don't.
I'll tell you one thing, though. If I had a table that made magic pencils, there is no way I would give that up.
Why are you selling? That was the, why are you selling that house? And then why are you also not using that as a feature to the future buyer? Be like, by the way, this table makes pencils.
Yeah, or Paranormal Pencil Company. You could sell those for top dollar.
I mean, seriously.
What happened
right?
to the pencils?
Come on.
I have a whole glass full of them still. So yeah. I have some of them. But, and you know, the other thing is too, is like, again, you say like, why would people sell that house? Like, that was right at that time period, right before the market crashed, when houses were just like selling for like tons of money right before the market bottomed out. And, you know, they wanted to get out, and they did. They perfect time, like, they got out. And then someone, like I said, someone bought that house for pennies on the dollar and then just destroyed it, like ripped it apart and redid it all modern. It looks terrible now.
I think you could make more money with a magic table. That's all I'm saying. Yeah.
Does the strange energy lie within the house or the table or the people that reside in it? In other words, is there still an energy in that new space, or is it completely evaporated, do you think?
No, the last time I was there, which was many years ago, like, it was the table for sure.
Wow.
Like, something was up with that table, because I moved that table around that room like it was huge, but, you know, the owner and I pushed it to each side and, you know, we flipped it upside down. Obviously, no pencils fell out of it when it was upside down. They'd have to hit the ceiling, but which would have been great, too. Like, a pencil shoot out from nowhere and launch itself into the ceiling. But, yeah, it was just something about the table.
Where was the table from? Like, how old was the table?
The table was original to the house. So the house was built in 1901. And like I said, it was a very missiony arts and Detroit was a big arts and crafts area at the time. So everything was quarter sawn oak and hardwood. And there were a lot of artistic kind of communes around the area. So everything was handcrafted and handmade. So I would imagine, you know, it was just handcrafted by some artisan in the area.
I have a question for you.
No. Hold on real quick. No, like, sigils or any weird inscriptions. Like, you didn't get a sense that, like, somebody was, like, purposely making a magic table.
No, not at all.
Okay.
But, you know, I will tell you, almost slightly related, years ago I had a case where a husband and wife in Rochester, Michigan, they thought their garage was haunted. Whenever they would go in their garage, they would get these, like, really crazy experiences of overwhelming dread. So I went out there and researched the land, researched the property. There was absolutely nothing strange had ever happened there. No cemeteries, nobody had ever died, no fires, no nothing. And I'm in the garage and I asked them if I could smoke in the garage. They said yes. So I was leaning there smoking, trying to think of what was happening. And as I was smoking, like, I started to get real agitated and real mad. And the clients came out and they're like, how you doing? And I yelled at the clients. It was so out of character for myself. I'm like, oh, so this is what they're experiencing. Like, they're experiencing this aggression. Mm. And I noticed that it was only when I was touching the garage. So I was like, who built this garage? So I went on this months long track talking to the builder and where the building supply had come from. And I found out that that garage had been built with reclaimed wood from a mental asylum.
Mm. Holy shit.
Oh, whoa.
Careful where you get your wood.
Seriously.
So I like have this idea in my head, like whether it's the table or the garage, like that these things hold something, that they have some kind of memory or purpose.
I mean, the question I was going to ask you, and I've always sort of been, I guess, fascinated might be the word, about the idea of these aporting objects, objects materializing out of nowhere. And you read a lot about them in the old spirit sessions that took place at the turn of the century and stuff like that, or even yogis and holy men being able to manifest objects. And before, I was always skeptical, I guess might be the word. But now that you've experienced it yourself, I mean, do you look back at a lot of those cases and go, oh my, in other words, did you ever question the ability of aportation before? And now do you have a different, you know, idea, Bryce, around it?
I love it when you start talking like Ray Stans. It really is great. Like when you're just like, when you go straight up Dan Aykroyd from Ghostbusters, it's like the best thing ever.
I really do. I mean, you know, one of those things, as a person who studies strangeness, is I was always fascinated with spiritualism and how they were hoaxing ectoplasm and
right.
how they were making trumpets float and luminescent hands and all of that stuff, and how they were having aporting objects. And I always felt in the back of my mind, you know, that was probably just some kind of trick. I knew that sometimes in, you know, one of the things that they would do in seance parlors is they would hide stuff on the top blade of a ceiling fan, and knowing that at some point it would flip off and hit a wall, and oh, there's your aporting object, you know? So like, I knew that it could be done and that people learned to, you know, flip coins with their toes, like just crazy stuff to get this to happen.
Yeah.
But over the years, I mean, I've experienced aporting objects aside from the pencils and stuff. I was filming an episode of Paranormal Lockdown with Nick Groff and Katrina Weidman. And we were in Franklin Castle in Ohio. And as we were walking around, like right in front of me, like this flash goes right before my eyes and I hear it hit the ground. And I look down and there's a buffalo head nickel. And it just came out of nowhere in this abandoned old house.
Wow.
And I picked it up and everybody was freaking out. And I it's crazy when you're filming, you know this, like from filming television shows, Bryce, like it's crazy that that doesn't make the cut.
Right. Like, I don't know where I put that.
Yeah. I am holding an object that came out of nowhere, and somewhere a producer is like, yeah, that's not scary.
That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to switch tracks a little bit, but we're going to keep it weird with John E.L. Tenney. We'll be right back with this week's story, or shall I say topic, of high strangeness.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting and rules for occurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop, opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text THIN to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text THIN to 200-300. That's THIN to 200-300. THIN to 200-300.
Before we get into this week's story of high strangeness, I did have one. I can't get over these pencils. I have one more question. You say they're normal. Have you brought any of those pencils in for like lab analysis anywhere?
Or yeah, run them by your EMF meter.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the problem is I've taken them places for people to look at, right, but I don't have the money to do actual chemical and spectral analysis of these pencils.
What we keep forgetting is it takes money to do
time, money, effort.
Right, lab reports. It's not free.
Yeah, for sure. And the thing that cracks me up the most is I was going over this case with a friend of mine who's a researcher of strange stuff, Brian, and he was laughing because he goes, this is such a weird, strange, amazing kind of case. But what the fuck does it even matter? Like, it's just pencils falling out of a table. Like, right, what is it? It doesn't prove anything. It doesn't prove that there's life after death or aliens or monsters. It just proves that these pencils appear out of nowhere. Like, what does that mean in the overall scheme of things? Nothing. And it is really ridiculous.
Right.
It just proves that we really are in a Pixar film, and it's just some sight gag, you know, that they keep the movie keeps cutting away to. We're just there to react to the stuff.
I still like this idea of, like, you know, things go missing around your house all the time, and how many people said, oh, it's the, you know, the little goblins, they like to take things, and maybe they're like, okay, we take a lot of shit, we need somewhere to put it. This table will work nicely.
Magic table, yeah.
But then they're just spitting it out in this couple's house outside of Detroit. It's not like anything fun is happening with the pencils.
Everything. But does that mean that there are like these lost object portals all over the world that we're just not paying attention to?
Yes. I think so. I think that's what I was getting at, yeah.
Whenever you hear like about like gnomes and elves who have these like huge caverns full of treasure, is it because all of your lost change goes to one cave?
Yeah. Whoa. There's a house in Spokane, Washington that has a lazy boy that shoots out old socks. Every time you recline, just socks fall out of it from your dryer.
Oh, don't mind the socks now.
It's like a tube system too. There's somebody who's got a, you know, pneumatic tubes. Blueprints. Yeah, like, yeah. I don't know. We can shoot this somewhere out on the East Coast, but nowhere past the Delta.
Oh man, yeah, it's like some weird, like you know, afterlife bureaucratic job where you just work in the pencil dimension transport factory, just loading pencils into tubes for eternity.
The guy just hates it, and he has to do it forever.
Yeah, forever.
Somebody please buy this house and destroy this fucking table.
Free me of my chains.
I don't work when people are watching me. Do not look at me do this. I can't do this if you're watching me.
What's even better is it's that guy's job in an alternate dimension to make sure that pencils don't get lost, but he's becomes so bored with the job, he's like, I'm just going to route him under that table for the drawing.
That sounds more realistic, yeah. To be honest.
Yeah. Fuck it.
All right. Well, it is Wet Hot Alien Summer 2, Summer Abduction, and we are in the thick of it right now. We have done, what did we do? We did the Coronado mass abduction event.
Yeah.
And I've really been in the world of alien grays, and we're gearing up for another deep dive that's going to stick with these guys. So I thought it would be good to kind of like pause in between big stories and take a look at these entities and talk about these entities. Because we haven't ever really done them before. You know, they've been in some of the stories that we've done. So tonight, we've invited John to discuss with us the Grays.
Yeah, great.
Dun, 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 dun.
Here we go. The classic gray alien contact or experience is extreme terror. I can relate to that, in a way. It's a very cold, mechanical kind of computer-like intelligence. It's what we perceive as artificial because it's not incarnated, and it never was, so it doesn't have any empathy or doesn't relate to that at all. This quote comes from director and magic practitioner Brian Butler during a 2012 interview with Vice reporter Liz Armstrong about his experience contacting what he calls extra-dimensional entities, typically referred to as the Grays. He goes on to say, "It's eternal, it's ancient, and it's also futuristic. It's from a dimension that's beyond what our perception of time is, too. So not only is it not a warm-blooded creature, it's also transcending the barriers of time and space. There are certain limitations you need to function in the world, such as a body. It's impossible for a human being to fully comprehend what it could be, just by nature of being alive. If you don't retain those things, such as an ego or sense of logic and reason, then you can't function in society. These entities operate outside of those rules, so it's very difficult to classify them. We can see a small part of them, but the whole thing is too much. It's overwhelming. It helps you to evolve, and it also can be terrifying, the vastness of where they're coming from. And just where do the Grays come from? We've encountered these iconic alien beings in so many stories here on the BCC, from Roswell to Benny and Barney Hill to our recent deep dive on the Coronado mass abduction event. Hell, I even kicked off my share of the podcast recounting the time my dogs and I saw something I would describe as an alien gray peering into my living room window at 4 a.m. one early June morning. And yet we've never devoted a segment of High Strangeness solely to these entities. Are they from outer space? The inner mind, the space between spaces, as John Hurt's character in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, Professor Harold Oxley, so elegantly put it. Are the Grays aliens or demons or something else? Or are they all of the above? Perhaps tonight's guest can lead us to some enlightenment on the subject. But before we dive into that discussion, I wanted to present a brief history of alien Grays. And I will try to keep this short, but here we go. Alien grays are typically described as being 3.5 to 5 feet tall, with thin androgynous bodies, spindly arms and legs with 4 fingers on each hand, commonly described as being webbed. Their skin is sometimes described as slightly reptilian in nature. Their oversized heads, bug-like, with pointed chins, narrow slits for nostrils, a thin, lipless mouth, which may or may not open to reveal a pocket. And of course, no portrait of a gray would be complete without its signature black, almond-shaped eyes. Oh yeah, and they are gray. Or occasionally wear tight gray bodysuits. They have also been described as having more of a pinkish-gray, earthly color to them. These childlike nightmare makers show up during UFO encounters and in abduction stories, appearing out of thin air or through, like a pencil, or through bright lights in a victim's bedroom late at night or in the wee hours of the morning. The abductee often, but not always, describes being paralyzed and levitated from their bed, taken aboard a ship where the Grays perform uncomfortable and terrifying experiments on them, seemingly for the purpose of harvesting DNA or reproductive materials for some sort of alien-human hybrid situation. Grays are often referred to as being cold and emotionless, although at times they've been known to reassure the experiencer with a telepathic message, something like, "Don't worry. This will be all over soon." Grays have the ability to erase people's minds, blocking their memory banks from the trauma of their abduction experience. Although, as we've learned, nothing stays buried forever. Often, they will send an abductee back to bed with a little souvenir from their trip around a spaceship, a tiny metallic implant hidden somewhere in their body. But where do the alien Grays come from? Before there was Betty and Barney Hill, there was H.G. Wells. In Wells' 1893 article, Man of the Year Million, Wells predicted that the human race would evolve into short, large-headed gray beings with enlarged eyes. A couple years earlier, a book called Meta, A Tale of the Future, introduced readers to a race of gray-skinned, futuristic aliens with big heads. A 1933 Swedish children's book by Gustav Sandgren called The Hidden Danger continued the budding existence of grays in pop culture with the description of these beings as, Bryce, I sent you a quote. I forgot to
yes.
tell you. Okay, great. Here you go.
The creatures did not resemble any race of humans. They were short, and their heads were big and bald with strong, square foreheads and very small noses and mouths and weak chins. What was most extraordinary about them were the eyes, large, dark, gleaming with a sharp gaze. They wore clothes made of soft gray fabric, and their limbs seemed to be similar to those of humans.
Sounds like a classic gray to me.
Yeah,
so far,
I'd say.
Yeah, right? But we're just kind of dealing with grays in fiction. So who was the first person to actually contact a gray? Some say that person was none other than infamous British occultist Aleister Crowley. Yes, in 1917, Crowley was living in New York City and conducting a series of magical experiments to contact extra-dimensional intelligence through a ritual known as the Amalantra working. Sorry, I fucked this up. The Amalantra working. There you go. Landed it. Nice, Michael. Basically, it's rumored that Crowley managed to open up a portal where he made contact with an entity he referred to as Lamb. L-A-M, all capitals. Crowley drew an illustration of Lamb, and it's been debated whether the drawing is of an extraterrestrial entity or a self-portrait of Crowley himself in the astral plane. But it's undeniable it shares an eerie resemblance to what we call grays today. Wouldn't it be wild if Crowley opened a portal to the grays' dimension, allowing them access to Earth and occasionally crash-landing in the New Mexican desert like they did outside of Roswell, New Mexico in 1947? Because that's the next major place the Greys, quote-unquote, show up until Betty and Barney Hill's abduction experience in 1961, which really began to establish their whole oeuvre in the 20th century pop culture and ufology. Skeptics have noted that before the Hill abduction, there was an episode of Outer Limits just a few days before Betty and Barney Hill were taken, featuring alien creatures that have a passing resemblance to the Greys. However, Betty recalled under hypnosis asking her captors to draw a map of where they were from, and the star chart Betty was allegedly presented resembled the star system Zeta Reticuli. Therefore, the Greys are commonly referred to as Zeta Reticulans. The next major abduction case that really spread the image of the Greys far and wide, mostly due to the illustration on the cover of its dust jacket, was Communion by Whitley Strieber, who wrote of his experiences of being abducted by alien Greys from his Catskills cabin in the early 80s. Were these the same Zeta Reticulans that kidnapped Betty and Barney Hill or crashed at Roswell? The theories are endless as to who or what these little guys actually are. In fact, it's possible that there may be different types of Greys. I'm sure you've heard us talk about tall Greys as well as little Greys. Well, what about renegade Greys from Zeta Reticuli that have been genetically altered by the tyrannical reptilian Orion Empire?
Renegade Greys, that's good. I'm writing that down.
The explanation put forth by author Craig Campobasso in his book, The Extraterrestrial Species Almanac. These are bad Greys that have been genetically altered by reptilian aliens called Draconians and are not the enlightened telepathic good Greys of Zeta Reticuli that are fighting against the influences of the evil Orin Empire along with the galactarian alignment of space peoples and planets. And both versions of Greys have the ability to phase through solid objects like walls and doors, and both versions will abduct you, but the good ones are just slightly nicer about it. And I didn't even really talk about the tall Greys and the even taller Greys. Yes, there are two types of tall Greys, tall and extra tall. Although the Fox Mulder heyday of alien abduction cases seems to have come and gone with the 1990s, could be up for debate, the image of the gray alien has never been more iconoclastic than it is in 2021. We see it everywhere, on stickers and skateboards, as characters in mainstream movies and cartoons, and as mascots on 420 novelty mugs. Hell, drive through Nevada and almost every truck stop you'll pass is selling alien beef jerky with a smiling alien gray face slapped on the wrapper. Whether they may be us from the future, interdimensional demons, or aliens from Zeta Reticuli, this phenomena is physically manifesting itself in our reality. It is possibly real and extremely deeply integrated into folklore, mass culture, and our psyches. At this point, I'm going to release the yoke of this Galactarian scout ship and hand the reins over to our guest, Johnny L. Tenney, and ask him, John, what the hell are the Grays?
I have no idea.
Thank you for listening. That's
have a good night. They are immensely strange, and you did a great job of putting how diverse everything is with the Grays too.
Thank you.
It really is amazing to me how the Grays caught fire so fast, especially, you know, I really started off in the late 80s and early 90s, and that's when Grays really had their heyday. It was just everywhere. The Schwa Corporation, that's when all the belt buckles and stickers and skate zines and everything just started putting alien heads on everything.
Yeah.
And for me, it was interesting as a researcher of odd stuff, because I am very interested in the kind of folkloric nature of things and how fiction can alter what seems to be our shared reality. And I've always been a big science fiction person. And so the alien gray never really scared me or seemed weird to me. It always seemed like an extension of things that I had been reading about in comic books and in science fiction books my whole life.
That's funny, because I remember the first time I ever saw the image of a gray, and it was on the cover of Communion at like Walden Books or B. Dalton at Oak Park Mall. And I remember taking one look at that thing and just like, it felt like a knife made of ice, like cut my spine. Like it just terrified me to the bone. And then it wasn't long after that sightings became popular. And they were doing all these stories where they would show like hand-drawn images of the Grays. And I was like, yep, nope, I know, like, no. Like, it really scared me. And yeah, maybe that was just because I wasn't exposed to that stuff yet, you know? I don't know.
Well, I can tell you, in the early 90s, when I was doing research for Unsolved Mysteries, we reached this point where we had all of these gray alien abduction stories. And we were also getting a lot of my son or daughter or wife or whoever was possessed story. And as a researcher, I'm looking at like, okay, so she's in bed and paralyzed, and there's this thing in the room and it's floating her. And I got to this point, I'm like, am I reading a possession story? Or am I reading an alien abduction story? Like, how are we portraying this? Are we going to show what she saw? Because she said that she saw an illuminated demon. But did she see a gray? Did she see an alien? Like, we're going by her perception of reality. Like, should we try and tell this story multifaceted as if we don't know, like, what it is? Of course, that was too deep for Unsolved Mysteries. They were like, no, we're going to do this as a possession, or no, we're going to do this as an alien abduction. But even as early as then, like, my mind was already expanding to the point of like, oh, so we're simply drawing on the experiencer's experience and what their religious, spiritual, non-spiritual, agnostic belief is, and going to say these are different when they might just be the same thing.
Right. Because there are people who believe that the Grays are, I mean, there's like entire books written about it, that the Grays
fallen
are
angels. Yeah.
Yeah. Demons, you know, or yeah, exactly. Fallen angels.
Yeah. And what's interesting, too, is if you talk to people who experiencers who have encountered and actually been able to either converse or have some kind of interaction with their grays, the thing that I find really interesting is that they can drive them away with invoking Jesus.
Right. Right. Well, so strange.
It comes up in a lot of this research that I was doing that, like, the way to protect yourself is to picture, like, it's kind of like you hear in, like, relaxation technique stuff where you're, like, picturing, or when you're, like, protecting yourself against, like, ghosts or demons, like, this idea of, like, projecting a big wall of light or imagining, literally, this actually follows up exactly what you said, John, like, picturing the Archangel Michael, you know, like, blocking you. And, like, that's a way to protect yourself against attacks or abductions by alien grays.
Yeah, and you have to wonder, like, is that repellent to the grays, or is it because it's reinforcing your own faith in something? You know what I mean? Like, is it right. Is it repellent to them, or is it just empowering to you?
Man, I mean, I've always vibed with this sort of pet theory that, you know, creatures like Bigfoot and the alien gray are these archetypal images, one sprouting forward in our timeline and one sprouting backwards in our timeline. And we, as the human, you know, Homo sapiens sapiens right now, are caught in the middle, right? And one seems to be our future and the other seems to be our past. And there's, you know, we manifest them through our unconscious psyche, perhaps as an individual or even more so as a collective. But I don't know, that always seemed to make sense to me, like strong, hairy, living in the woods off the land and moving into cities and then off into space, and our brains get bigger, our mouths get smaller, we lose our penises. So I don't know.
We're being cloned. They're clones. If you don't, right, you know, right. You don't have your belly button, you don't have reproductive organs.
Yeah. I mean, that's just like on an unconscious Jung level. I also have no problem with, you know, Bigfoot being an interdimensional being all on its own and an alien gray being an interdimensional being all on its own. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the universe is weird enough to, I mean, I've talked about this a lot, probably with you guys too. Like, my point of view is the universe is endless and boundless and endlessly creative.
Right.
And so for all of those things to exist simultaneously, I have no problem with the idea that there is a humanoid Bigfoot and there is an alien Bigfoot and there is an interdimensional Bigfoot, and they are all coexisting or co-non-existing or co-consciously existing at the same time. I think the universe is like, let's give you everything. Let's do it all at once.
That's so great. I love that. You know, how much weight do you put into the power of a guy like Crowley's manifestations? I mean, we've seen the power of occult manifestation in guys like L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons. But when it comes to the OG, Aleister Crowley, like, you know, could he have done like what Michael said in his Tale of High Strangeness? Could he have opened up a portal to these gray beings?
I mean, again, I'm allowing for any and all possibilities, yeah. So I can say yes. But with the old Crow himself, like, when I look at pictures of Lamb, when I look at his picture of the being that people show, like, oh, he channeled some kind of gray, he channeled a space alien. Like, as a researcher, the thing that I think about often is, like, okay, you know, the name Lamb that he named it is a name given to the root chakra, right? So it's your base chakra that controls your sexual energies.
Wow.
And if you really look at that picture of Lamb, like, it looks like a penis tip going into a vagina.
Yeah, wow. I'm looking at it right now.
I'm
and
Googling
you are
now.
100%
yeah, I can just
correct.
Hear people pulling over in their cars like,
oh, it's not titillating, guys. So just keep driving. Keep heading, you know, to Chick-fil-A. You can look at it.
I mean, it literally looks like the underside of a male penis going into a vagina.
Oh my God. And then he
drew some eyes on the glands on the underneath of the penis. Like,
yep.
So wild. Almost, it's like that Virgin Mary motif is really just a vulva and vagina, you know, the Fatima and
Yeah, for sure.
Yes, because you're
comes back to the penis.
You're
the
praying to the source of life. But so this is great because, and then also I think like lamb is associated with this is getting into like old magical languages and old world languages, but like also the way or the path also, which would kind of like okay, I can line that up with like the path,
the root, being a sexual the root, thing. The origin. Yep.
I'll never look at that picture the same way again.
That is so. But so does that mean that alien graves are just upside down dicks in walking around vaginas? Walking vaginas?
I mean, maybe that was just, I mean, you know, you never know with Alistair, like what he was trying to get across, what message he was trying to get across. Maybe he did it invoke some kind of extraterrestrial or interdimensional force. Like, again, it's all on the table.
Yeah.
But you at the two, when you have to, like, this is my difficulty sometimes when I'm researching, like I have to look at what was going on at the time and how old were people. And so, you know, you were talking about H.G. Wells talking about The Man in a Million Years. And when you start to look backwards at this period of time, so 1900, when the century flipped, I think Alistair is like 24 years old, right? And the newspapers are filled with stories about what is man going to be like in the future. Mm-hmm. There's a biology professor named Henry Bruner who wrote an article that was in the New York Times, and it was called The Future Man. And he draws a picture of someone with a giant head and big eyes and really soft proportioned body. There's another article in 1904 called What's the Matter with Martians? And it draws a spindly body and a big head. And you have to remember, like, Aleister Crowley is like, again, he's like 25, 26 years old. And all of this stuff is going to his mind. Aside from all of the magic and occult stuff he's doing, he's also there for the birth of science fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that even, I mean, like Superman, you know, which is a little bit later, you know, but Siegel and Shuster were trying to sell Superman to newspaper strips for a while. And like the first incarnation of Superman was supposed to be this like futuristic master man that was more of a villain. He was actually more like Lex Luthor than he was Superman. But still, you know, Superman's called the Man of Tomorrow. So that all, like, you know, it makes me think of, like, that we really were thinking about the future around that time. And that is, you know, that's where we get, you know, War of the Worlds is turn of the century. The first Man on the Moon. Is that the name of the Wells book? Jules Verne. And then Wells also did something about creatures on the moon. So now I'm getting confused. But it is interesting, this whole idea of like just running with the sex thing, right? Because the thing that usually happens to people when they're brought up in a ship with Greys is like some weird sexual experiment is performed on them. You know, sometimes like in the case, what's that one from the 50s where the farmer in Central America was like taken aboard and that like hot alien babe like mated with him. You know,
Villa Boas.
There's this. I wonder if we're looking at it from the way that if like, what if the Greys are somehow this physical manifestation of like all of our sexual anxieties as a planetary system? You know what I mean? Because if we think about sex as a magical act, which people who aren't even into the occult describe it as, it's the thing that creates life. People are just like. The characters in Dazed and Confused are saying all the time, they're just like, think about all the people out there just fucking right now. You know what I mean? It's like, it's a magical act that's always taking place, right? So maybe we've all like conjured these living embodiments of like weird sexual anxiety. You know what I mean? Maybe that's what they are.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that being one aspect totally makes sense to me. And then I also think to myself, like, you know, when we talk about first ideas and original concepts, like why did science fiction burst forth at the same time all over the planet? Like why did everyone start writing science fiction stories all within 20 years of each other? Like were we also being subtly influenced to push ourselves at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution to go further and faster by some other entity or by some other force that like was trying to get us to progress on a path?
Mm-hmm. Fulfill our destiny. Yeah, absolutely. In a timely manner. You know, speaking of those, you know, just going off that, you know, the opposites and male and female and stuff, I was reading from Where the Footprints End, Volume 2, but there's a little section on John Mack, famed Harvard psychologist and UFO abduction researcher. And it just states that he evoked the concept of the reified metaphor, the notion that supernatural phenomena employ symbolic manifestations to impart their true intentions in our reality. In Mack's work, paranormal phenomena utilize symbolic presentations to convey their meaning, e.g., human-alien hybrids don't represent actual literal offspring, but rather a coincidentia oppositorium, of union of opposites, which denizens of the other world wish to invoke. I just love that, the idea that invoking this balance of opposites, the black, the white, the yin and the yang, the male and the female, there's such power in that, you know? And I don't know.
There is, but also isn't it, sorry to jump on you.
No, that's it.
No, but this inspired me. But also, aren't we living in a time right now where we're like starting to wake up from thinking about things as binary? You know what I mean? And these entities or the variations of all these different grays or all these different aliens and all the weird shit, like John, you're talking about, like, there can be Bigfoot that's from the forest. There can also be Bigfoot from a spaceship or Bigfoot from another dimension. Like,
yeah,
maybe this is like all teaching us that there's such a broad spectrum of just everything. It's not just the opposites being attracted or coming together to create one, you know. But I don't know. I mean,
I love Mac's idea that, well, and it's not just his, but the other people who have suggested that, you know, the kind of archetypes and the path that we need to be on has to reveal itself in even those strange ways that we might be able to understand it and perceive it. And so when you look at something like grays and hybrid children and abductions and stuff like that, like the abductions are traumatic and the hybrid children is, you know, the union of this one thing and this other thing. Mm. But the lesson too about the grays is that they're always kind of perceived as evil because they're all exactly the same.
Right.
Mm. You know? And so there's also this conscious idea that's set within you that, like, but you don't want to get to this point. You don't want to get to the point where you're all exactly the same because you are unique and individual.
Right. Mm. Wow. That makes so much sense.
That gives me some chills. And that reminds me of like Betty and Barney Hill's description of when they were looking at the craft from the ground and they could see the aliens walking around through the like windshield of the spacecraft on the deck. They said that they moved moved kind of like clockwork. And Barney was like, these guys look like Nazis. Like they all seem very like, you know, they looked like they, he's like, I've seen this, and they act and behave like Nazis. And so that when I think of Nazis, I think of like one-minded, you know, stormtroopers. You know what I mean?
Just yeah, and they like, and Barney and Betty's aliens were wearing little uniforms too, right, little hats, right. And little uniforms. Yeah,
right. So I don't know, but you mentioned last time on the show that you think that maybe that whole thing was like a government MK Ultra, early MK Ultra experiment, maybe. So maybe this all is, you know, human made as well. I don't know.
I do think, like, you know, whether I don't, you guys know this, I don't believe anything, but I have a lot of ideas right. on stuff. And I do think that, you know, if there were contacts happening all over the planet, like, let's say in the 1950s with the contactee movement, that yes, someone with money or power would want to be like, oh, how can we use this to our benefit? Can we reproduce this? Can we use this to our benefit? We probably can go to people who aren't so well educated and probably fool them with some technology that, you know, they wouldn't even expect to have, whether that even be a helicopter or just some bright lights or a jet, you know what I mean? People back in the 1950s, a lot of them weren't well read. They didn't have the internet. They didn't know what was capable of the technology of the government back then. And so I think there probably were experiments that were done to see what would happen. I think it's Barney and Betty have always interested me because they're a mixed race couple. It's, there's a lot to Betty and Barney where I think maybe someone was trying something out with them.
Mm. Wild.
What do you say to people, I mean, like yourself, who have seen pencils fall out of underneath tables, like me, who saw something like, when I saw what I saw, it seemed very tangible and very, very real. And my dogs were seeing it too. What do you say to the people who were like, no, 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 this wasn't a metaphor. This wasn't hallucination. This was an actual physical entity in my room. And I saw it just the way I'm looking at this glass of water. You know,
so what I tell them is, so the last woman that I dated, we had started dating and she told me, listen, you know, I don't want to be abducted by aliens and I don't want to see Bigfoot and I don't want ghosts in the house and stuff like that. And I said, well, you know, I'll do what I can, but no promises.
Wear this necklace real quick. Yeah.
And so we had been dating a couple months and she was dog sitting for a friend of hers. And she just asked me if I wanted to come over and dog sit with her and spend the night. And I said, yeah. So I went over and we were dog sitting and we went to bed that night. And I woke up in fear. Like, there's no better way to kind of explain that. Like, I just woke up in panic mode and I was sweating. I was super hot and I didn't want to move. I didn't want to wake her up. And I didn't know if I was having an anxiety attack or a panic attack or something, but I could have sworn that there was a giant flash of light, which is what woke me up and scared me. I thought someone was in the room taking pictures and I thought someone was still in the room hiding in the shadows. And so I very, without moving my head or anything, I just kind of turned my eyes toward her in the darkness and she was awake too. And I said, did you see a flash of light? And she said, yes.
Ugh.
And I said, is someone in the room with us? And she said, I think so. And then my heart started pounding and I just started getting like really scared. And I mean, I don't know if it's an intruder, but I've also got all this alien and UFO stuff in my mind from 30 years of it. Yeah. You know? And so I'm like, I told her, I just real quietly, I said, I'm just going to turn the light on. And I really quickly reached my hand over and turned the light on that was next to the bed. And the room was empty and there was no one there, obviously. And we sat on the edge of the bed and she said, I think this relationship might be over because I think there was an alien in this room.
Wow. Bummer.
We've got you again, Tenny.
You will never be in a
relationship other than ours.
Well, but that's crazy because that's like how the, you know.
That was Coronado to a T.
Yeah, Coronado. Like they woke up in the
bang,
hotel
flash
room
light,
because of a
gone,
flash of light
shadow in
that
a room.
Caught their attention. And then
shadows
there was
turns to aliens.
In the room.
Yeah. And not to be too, well, I don't have any secrets, so people should know that right off the bat. But the other thing that I started thinking about after that night, I mean, that I didn't go back to sleep. I stayed awake. She went back to sleep, but I stayed awake. Yeah. And I was just sitting in the kitchen, in this strange kitchen of this person's house who I was dog sitting. And I was just formulating. And I realized, again, I don't have any secrets. I realized like how sexually charged that experience had also been, like that night. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's really weird. Like neither of us are really hypersexual like that, but we were that night.
What?
Mm-hmm. Wow. And then that started like feeding into my brain of like, was something elevating like the chemicals in our brain? Like, I don't know. It's just, it's still very, very,
sure.
And she won't, I'm still friends with her, but she refuses to talk about it.
Wow.
And it makes you wonder too, since that was neither one of your houses either. That the house didn't belong to either one of you. That I wonder if other stuff's gone on in that house.
Yeah, I don't know. I never brought it up to the people. She never talked about it. I mean, and the other thing that I thought was strange too is that when she went back to sleep and I got up, the dog was in the living room just sound asleep. So the dog had no reaction to anything that was going on in that room.
It's strange, you know, when you hear these stories like the Coronado event and all this stuff where these entities are just walking through solid doors, you know, the grays really do at a certain point become interchangeable with ghosts, you know.
For sure. And, you know, there is a part of me as a researcher, like I can't help but think that some of the experiences might be you know, leftover kind of genetic memory. I spent a lot of time up in the woods growing up at my parents' cabin in northern Michigan. And, you know, when I read about grays and I read about alien abductions, I try and look at it through a natural lens of the world. And I've seen enough owls swoop out of the night and grab tiny mice and disappear into the darkness to think to myself, is there a part of my brain that remembers being a mouse and these dark eyes silently coming out of the night and grabbing me and taking me up into the heavens? Yes. Like, is that a part of it too?
Fucking yes. That's a myth. Yes.
Or
I do believe we hold that. I do believe our DNA can pass on experiential memory. Absolutely.
And or have we gotten so big for our britches, the human race on this planet, that our psyches have to create an apex predator, you know, to keep in our minds, to keep our like bodies and reptilian brain like functioning, you know what I mean? Like, does it in a way keep us driven? You know what I mean? To know that there's still something out there that could come get us, you know?
Yeah. That motivates us to keep going. I'll tell you another, if you've got time for this.
Yes, yes, yes.
Some super high strangeness. So I have, over the years, my friends, we call it the force field. I have a force field over my house because I go to so many screwed up locations. I don't want ghosts and entities following me home. So I'm always safe in my house. So I have this, what I call a force field over my house. Keeps all the bad stuff out. So I was really tired going through some stuff last year and not sleeping very well. And I had this waking dream. My bedroom's on the second floor and I was laying in bed kind of watching television. I did that thing where I fell asleep, but didn't know I was asleep. And I heard someone knocking on my window on the second floor. Oof. So I get up, not really knowing I'm asleep. And I get up and I walk over to the window and I peel the curtain back. And sitting on the roof of my house, knocking on my window, I don't know if you guys know, have you guys ever discussed the Saucerian and Gray Barker, the Silver Bridge Mothman, Gray Barker?
Barker's come up. We've done Mothman, and we've talked about it, the Mothman prophecies. We haven't really dug too deeply into Gray Barker.
In my dream, he's on my roof.
This is the guy who wrote They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, right? And
and the book The Silver Bridge, which was the Mothman first kind of book. So anyway, I see Gray out on my roof and I kind of laugh and I'm like, Gray, what are you doing out there? And he starts laughing. He's got this big wide tie on, his stupid glasses, and he goes, I won. And I go, what do you mean you won? And I'm fully like the most realized awake dream. Like this is, it's just blowing my mind. And I think at this point I'm starting to realize I might be asleep. Mm-hmm. And I go, Gray, what do you mean you won? And he starts laughing and he floats backwards off of my roof. And I'm watching him disappear up into the sky. And he's laughing and he's going, I won, I won. And I scream through my window. I go, what do you mean you won? And right before he vanishes into the sky, he goes, John, the aliens, they're all named after me.
Ooh, dude. that just gave me the worst fucking goosebumps ever.
I hate and love that story.
Well, it freaked me out because in my head, right before you said it, I was like, Gray Barker. And then you said it.
And it's not Grays, it's Grays with an apostrophe.
Whoa, yeah.
It's Grays aliens, not Gray aliens. And when we call them Grays, we're legitimately saying they're his.
Wow, that's...
Oh, whoa. Yes,
that's gonna take me some time to process all that.
That really kind of fucked me up. Because the other thing is, too, is I've done this for a long time and I never put it together that his name is Gray and he's a guy who writes about aliens.
Yeah. That's so weird. That's very strange. Love it.
So maybe instead of the Formanauts, it should be the Johnanauts.
Yes. Tenny nuts.
They're mine. They're mine now.
I don't want them. Trust me. I mean, I'll hang out with them and maybe drink a have a vodka or something, but
yeah,
I don't need them around my house.
Some future paranormal researcher is going to wake up in a dream one day with you knocking on their window.
Yeah,
I can only hope.
That would be rad. That would be rad. Well, John, amazing guest as always. It's so great to have you on the show. This should be more than an annual event.
I'm gonna ask for 5 more minutes.
Oh, please. Oh, yeah. So I know you were traveling, man. So I didn't want to take your time. Yes,
Riley, do you think you can play that MP3 that I sent you?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so I'll set this up before you play it. I researched a case with a husband and wife who said they were being abducted by grays, and went round and round with them, investigated them as much as I could. And I don't know how well this is going to sound. It was recorded off of an old style answering machine, but during their abduction, the husband reached over and pressed the record button on their answering machine.
Oh my God.
Whoa. And so the sound you're going to hear, according to them, you'll hear her and him talking while you hear a whooshing sound, which is the ship / portal that has opened up in their room. And then you'll hear the wife scream right before the tape ends.
Shut up. Oh, my God.
All right.
Let me grab a protective crystal before I listen to this.
Yep. Everyone imagine light pyramids.
grab the Archangel Michael and sit him right on your lap.
Stand by. Oh, wow. That's insane.
So if that's what it claims to be, that you've just heard people being abducted.
Yikes.
That is really is insane.
So did he start recording because he had a sense that it was coming, or it had already started?
So the wife would wake up first in all the situations and alert him that something was happening. And in this instance, I had been researching with them, and I told them, like, you know, if you can ever do anything and
get some proof,
in his mind, it was, you know, the answering machine's right there next to the bed, just hit the record button. And so while this was happening, he hit the record button and got that sound on there.
That is insane. I mean, how many abduction stories do you read where they're like, I need to grab something. I need to take something. You know what I mean? I need to bring something back. That's, I've never heard of somebody being quick enough to think, oh shit, just hit the fucking record button.
Yeah.
This is why we need analog equipment next to our beds at all times. Because like the steps I would have to go through to unlock my phone and find my camera and get the camera ready or the audio, like the recorder ready, my head would already be on a chihuahua's body.
Yeah.
Well, for years, I kept a dream diary next to my bed and I'd wake up and write down my dreams. But over the past few years, I keep a instant press digital recorder next to my bed. And all I have to do is reach over and grab it and hit record and then start talking. And I'll tell you what, if you've never recorded yourself talking straight out of a dream and then falling back asleep and listening to it the next morning, it's pretty fucked up.
Oh, like, man.
You don't really remember what you said, and it's all bizarre dream language and dream words. It's pretty great.
I always hated writing in my dream journal because I couldn't keep up fast enough. You know what I mean? It's so visual, and I'm just trying to like translate it into fucking words, and it never worked. And I was like, that's so smart. Yeah.
But it's crazy too, right? When you read your dream diary, though, like
makes
even
no
though
sense.
it doesn't read right, but in your brain you can see it the way it happened in the dream.
Yeah, it's a different form altogether.
That happened to me recently. I heard like I was like hearing a song in my dream and I wanted to record the melody of it. So like I woke up and I instantly started recording my voice on my like, you know, voice memo app, but try singing at 5:45 in the morning. It's not, it sounds really bad.
I had a dream many years ago that I was on a stage in front of like 100,000 people and I had written the greatest song in history. And I woke up and I wrote down the lyrics and then fell back asleep. And I woke up in the morning and I had to go to work and I was at work and I was like, oh shit, I wrote down that most popular famous song in the world, the one that's going to make me famous. I got to get home. I got to like look at the lyrics and remember it because I can't remember the song. And I went home and looked in my dream book and it was the lyrics to Karma Chameleon by Columbia.
That checks out.
That's so awesome.
On that note, man, yeah. John, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for illuminating our podcast, man. You are just the best.
No, thanks for having me. I always have so much fun.
John, we don't know where to find the Karma Chameleon, but where can our listeners find you?
I've tried to make everything as simple as possible. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook is all John E.L. Tenney, or they can just type Tenney, T-E-N-N-E-Y, weirdo, into Google and follow it wherever it goes.
There Perfect. You go. And we'll throw your website and stuff up on the show notes of this episode. Boys, anything to plug? I feel like I had something and now I can't remember what it is. But guys, what do you got?
Grace has another new single out. It's called Tryst, and it is great.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah. And you're shooting a video for it, too, right?
We're shooting a video for it? Yeah, that's coming, too.
More Grace and Riley. More Grace and Riley.
It's coming. And, you know, if you haven't seen the Mango video, check that one out, too.
Awesome.
Fantastic. All right, well, let's say good night.
And go get regressed.
Thanks again, John.
Thanks.
Bigfoot Collectors Club is produced by Riley Bray. Our theme song is Come Alone by Sun Eaters, courtesy of Lotus Pool Records. If you like the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps get the podcast to more listeners. To support the show, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/Bigfoot Collectors Club and unlock multiple reward episodes every month.
Hey guys, Heather Ashley here, host of the Big Mad True Crime Podcast. If you're looking for a true crime podcast with all of the details and none of the small talk, you have found your people. Each week, we dive deep into a new case and learn everything there is to know, from getting to know the victim and the impact their case has had on those around them, to the investigation into what happened to them and who is or might be responsible. And if the bad guy looks like he might drink whiskey by a dumpster or has the social skills of an ogre, we say it because we were all thinking it anyway. As the name suggests, we get big mad over true crime, and I would love to have you join our incredible community of listeners with big hearts and zero time for small talk. Subscribe to Big Mad True Crime anywhere you listen to podcasts and listen to new episodes every single Monday.
Hey, this is Eric Molinsky, host of the podcast Imaginary Worlds. Each episode, I explore different sci-fi fantasy genres, talking with filmmakers, novelists, game designers, cosplayers, comic book artists, and anyone who works in the field of make-believe. I also look at the fan experience, asking, why do we suspend our disbelief? You can subscribe to Imaginary Worlds wherever you get your podcasts.